Hi, and welcome to the Read of the Week, where we open the trove of artifacts that are defined by words and worlds they lock in. Who knows? This trove can be your Read of the Week. Hi, I'm Ahmed Sharif, and joining me today is L. Subramani, my colleague. Hi, sir. Welcome to Read of the Week.
Hi, Ahmed. Thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you to be discussing the books.
Shall we open the trove?
Yes.
Hi, sir. Welcome to another episode of the Reads of the Week.
Hi, Ahmed. Thank you very much. And as usual, it's wonderful to talk about the stuff that we read. Reading is anyway a very private activity, and it's refreshing to sort of have the luxury to sit and discuss.
Yes, yes. So, what was your week like, sir? What was the previous week like for you?
Well, it was when you kind of go with a particular genre of book, you kind of tend to sort of go full throttle into it. And that's how it was for me. I first completed Jugalbandi by Vinay Sitapati. And then, it was a very absorbing political book, which I will talk about in a while. But, when I finished that, I thought, well, this man has a very, very uncanny skill of telling a story without compromising the scholarly discipline. He meticulously fact checks whatever he says. There is either a newspaper account of it, or an interview, or So he is very meticulous about whatever he writes being factual. But that does not mean that, it ends up becoming a sort of an academic exercise. It's a very interesting read. He's able to, blend this scholarly, sort of approach with storytelling in a wonderful way. So that's something that must be said about Vinay Sitapati. And that kind of interested me to sort of read Narasimha Rao. Because... You can kind of think that BJP is the flavor of the season, so it's much easier to talk about BJP, but you can't say the same about Narasimha Rao. Narasimha Rao is a very sort of a forgotten prime minister from a very, very forgotten era, and honestly, why I liked it is because that was the time I was growing up, I was getting to college, we were talking about the brands, the sort of the new cars and cell phones. And that was a time when India was opening. It was a very fantastic period in our economic history. And also, I feel that, it was a time when India was started to look, the world nations sort of, sat up and took a very good look at India. That was also probably the time when, India was beginning to be dehyphenated from Pakistan. Earlier, in the earlier 1990s, it was always India-Pakistan relationship or South Asian cooperation or South Asian relationship. But after the late 1990s, you can always kind of see that India coming of its own and standing up to the world nations and gaining, acceptability because of the economic growth and people, wanted to do business with India. So that was a very exciting period of time. And, I kind of finished it in a single day. That was a very, very good book. So, yes, it is. It's sort of once, you are carried by that, swept by that wind of, interest and enthusiasm, you sort of seem to go with it. That's how it was for me. And what I must tell you about these two books is that, as I said, it's imminently readable. That's one thing. And who would like to hate to put books in a particular pigeonhole and call it a certain genre. It helps marketing, no doubt, because it makes it easier for booksellers to put it out as some sort of a genre book. But I agree with Stephen King. Stephen King says that essentially any book, you know, it could be political book or it could be, you know, a cricket book or any book, it has to tell you a story. You know, any book that tells you a story appeals to you. I think on that score, I should say that both Sitapati's books were excellent stories. And you know, Vajpayee Advani. Let's come to the flavor of the season.
Jugalbandi.
You know, what I like about the book is the fact that it reads like Cain and Abel. In fact, I have written that in my review, which is I gave it for our Sunday magazine. This is like unlike the original Jeffrey Archer's. I'm not talking about the biblical Cain and Abel. I'm talking about the Jeffrey Archer. Cain and Abel. You know?
Okay.
Archer, Cain and Abel, you know, they end up becoming rivals to each other. You know, there's a banker and there's a businessman, you know, who come from very, very contrasting backgrounds. And incidentally, one guy is actually a migrant, you know, like how it happens in Advani's case in the real story. So it is basically a rivalry. But here, if you look at it, you know, it is from the beginning, it has been a partnership, about a six decade of partnership between two very contrasting personalities. And, you know, they were sort of welded together in the cauldron of, you know, Hindutva, the cauldron of RSS Hindutva platform. One was Pracharak. And Advani lands up in India from Karachi, where he grew up, where he spent up to his teenagers. He's there. At the age of 19, he comes to India. And here, he becomes a Pracharak in Rajasthan, you know, the dusty sort of a desert area where he starts being an RSS Pracharak. Well, Vajpayee actually was a Gangetic Brahmin who whose family migrates to Gwalior. And you know, he studies under the patronage of the Maharaja. I mean, this is very funny because if you happen to read books from the 1980s, you know, you know that Vajpayee actually stood against, you know, Madhavrao Sindhya, who's from the Maharaja clan. So the Maharaja's family that kind of gave him the scholarship to study, he ended up, you know, sort of standing up in the elections against them. So but Vajpayee kind of has this poetic flair about the way he talks, and he kind of picks it from his father, and immediately recognized as the intellectual in the Sangha Parivar. So he ends up becoming the editor of their magazine, their newspaper. I think it's Panchajanya, if I'm not wrong. And then slowly, you know, he becomes the face of the Janasangh in parliament. So again, you know, it's a very clearly demarcated you know, line of activity between these two. You know, one actually goes into the parliament and becomes speaks for the party and the ideology, and the other one becomes a purely organizational man. The stories are kind of beautifully progresses in the way where these two gentlemen are bringing the party and the ideology from political banishment. So you know the story. Well, you know, when Mahatma Gandhi was assassinated, the blame fell on the RSS. Okay, so there is this need to mainstreamize the party. And when you mainstreamize the party, it is basically trying to play within the Nehruvian framework, because Nehruvian framework was at that time the mainstream of Indian polity. You know, institutions like parliament. And then, you know, there are certain extremely classic Nehruvian style of functioning, which the two have to sort of follow. And post Nehru, you know, the emergency agitation and the post emergency politics gives them the actual chance to become mainstream. Yeah. So this book actually it takes up the story of Vajpayee Advani from the 60s, you know, where you have this Nehruvian system being the mainstream system. Their job was actually bring the party to the mainstream, you know. Before them, there were the Deen Dayal Upadhyay and Shyama Prasad Mukherjee. Both of them could not, you know, completely, you know, sort of cement the party's position as a force to reckon with. But that job almost kind of fell on Vajpayee and Advani. And right from the beginning, you know, they kind of, you know, got together to sort of defeat the political enemies from within. And then, you know, then came the emergency, you know, the emergency and the post-emergency period, which actually made the party a sort of a mainstay of Indian, you know, politics. That was in the late 70s. And we all know the story about, you know, first the merger of the Janasangh with the greater Janata Party, and then the formation of the BJP. You know, it's, so basically, the party actually kind of started to live the vision of Savarkar and the founders of the RSS, who thought, you know, who are like thinking that, you know, okay, there is the Hindu majority and we have to galvanize Hindu majority to win elections. Basically, that was their purpose. But that did not happen in the first few decades of the post-independent India. But it started to kind of happen after the Rama Janmabhoomi issue and after Advani's Rath Yatra. Now, what must be said here is the uniqueness of this partnership. You know, until I read Sitapati's book, I never realized that, you know, this Advani Vajpayee duo is kind of very unique in Indian politics. Because, you know, okay, you know that one established leader would be there, and there's another guy who sort of either remain his lieutenant or, you know, sort of the party organizer. But it wasn't just that, you know. One could step back for the other. That is one very, very interesting sort of thing that you can see in their life history. You know, when Vajpayee, when Advani was leading the Rath Yatra, Vajpayee was not in the limelight. In fact, there was a reporter who was asking him, are you marginalized? And then in typical Vajpayee fashion, he says, you know, sometimes the corrections happen in the margins. So so it's nice like one. That. Very, very typical of Vajpayee. And, you know, when the party is kind of ready for power, it was Advani who decides that, you know, he has to step back and give the podium to Vajpayee. You know, very canny politicians, very, very, very shrewd and smart politicians, because they know that, you know, they need to build coalition. In the 90s, it wasn't the brute majority that BJP was going to get. It was not, you know, even close to that. So Vajpayee is the only consensus candidate, the liberal face of the party. So Advani steps back. So that you don't see in any other, you know, sort of political partnership. Okay. So I must definitely tell you that, you know, this again, I've mentioned it in my review, my book review, which is, you know, politics is not just the recounting of events. You know, a political book is not, especially not a book of this kind, because, you know, okay, most of us may not know much about the pre-emergency politics, but post-emergency, most of us would have read something or the other somewhere. We know that we are familiar with the politics, the events, the that shaped the BJP. But what is so remarkable about this book, or I guess any political book, is that it sort of shines the light on the human side of the cast of characters. You know, when it becomes absolutely human. You know, one thing that must be said about these two, you know, people is that they are by nature very soft. It's a very contradictory sort of a thing, you know. Hardliners being very soft, you know, hardline politics they practice, but as individuals they're very soft. And I say this particularly because, you know, these two gentlemen never wanted to cross the line. They wanted to sort of create this en masse voting base, yeah, but they never wanted to cross the line. Okay, if you look at the demolition of the Babri Masjid, which is the primary incident in both Narasimha Rao's book and, you know, the Vajpayee Advani book. Advani, you know, from all, even he's again recollecting it from all the first-hand accounts and also from the papers, reportage of the event. that Advani was distraught because, you know, there was an assurance given by Kalyan Singh at that time that the mosque would not fall. Okay.
Yeah.
And then secondly, you know, Advani spoke to Narasimha Rao, according to Sitapati's research. They both spoke, the Prime Minister and at that time Advani was the leader of the opposition. He spoke and then they agreed that it will not happen. Imagine, you know, the chagrin, to his chagrin, he was present on the spot and then he is watching the falling away of the structure. That was a very human sort of a side. I say this because it's not easy, okay? Given the softer nature of these people, I don't think they would have wanted that to happen. Okay, now that after reading this book, I'm very clear that these two personalities per se would not have allowed any harm to happen to the Muslims, or they wouldn't have allowed a demolition of a structure. They wanted it to play politics with it. Yeah, that's fine. But they wouldn't have allowed it to fall. When that fell, you know, he has sort of captured Advani's reaction, because first he captures the microphone and then pleads the Karasevaks to get down. That doesn't work. And then, you know, he sort of sits down, you know, heavily on the chair without, you know, helplessly, rather extremely helpless. That sort of creates a rift between Narasimha Rao and Advani that I come to read from both the books, by the way. So that is a human, very human side of a person, because he has unleashed forces that he has no longer controlling. You know, he was no longer controlling. That
control
was
over
Advani, yeah. at the December the 6th demolition. Okay, now you fast forward and come to the Gujarat riots of 2002, Vajpayee. So if there is one event that almost sort of you know, created a complete and probably the permanent rift between the two partners, it was ironically, it was Narendra Modi. And on Narendra Modi, they fought bitterly than anything else anywhere. Vajpayee was, you know, wanted to dismiss the Narendra Modi government in 2002. But Advani was, you know, kind of standing for it. You know, because Advani, remember, is an organization man. And he knows that somewhere in this tragedy, they sort of felt that, okay, this is the best way to sort of retain power, because they didn't want to lose Gujarat. Losing Gujarat was like costly, and if they remove Narendra Modi, it was like accepting that, you know, they've got something to do with it, because all along they have been portraying this as a riot. You know, it's sort of an emotional outburst from both sides, and that's how they wanted it to stay. And Narendra Modi, they wanted to sort of keeping in the clear. But you know, Vajpayee knows that. And, you know, in his frustration, he was almost writing his resignation letter. That's how Jaswant Singh finds him. And then he kind of pulls his hand from the paper, you know. Very, very emotional sort of a moment. If you read that, you can almost feel the emotion. You know, that makes this book slightly apart from any political account that you would read. Because, you know, it's in the conflicts that you come to really see the human nature, okay? And also, it's very ironical, again, you know, if you cynically, I mean, I'm just saying a cynical interpretation of this is, you know, when Hindutva was succeeding, the both the, you know, sort of primary players in it were not happy. That is how it is. And because they know that it is sort of getting to a dangerous level from where it is difficult to sort of roll it back. So, and also the other tragedy is Advani could not become Prime Minister. In fact, it was Vajpayee's intention that once they win the 2004 elections, he wanted to install Advani and then retire. You know, but of course, they lost that election, and 2009, when you know, Advani had a chance to lead this party, he could not win. You know, that sort of brought a tragic curtain on the, you know, politics of these two gentlemen. So this is a book that must be read because of the story, because of the story. And also, you know, if there is something that the opposition can learn, it is how strong narratives are formed on the history of the politics that they follow. You know, if they miss the point, and probably BJP would be sort of continuing to dominate. If they ever have to learn anything, it's the fact that, you know, they need to work in tandem with the other to defeat a stronger BJP. That's the lesson that I could draw from this. If there is one thing that you can learn from this partnership, it's the fact that, you know, they put the victory and their political progress above personal rivalry and petty politics. You know, for example, Advani and Vajpayee sort of did not particularly agree with the events that led to the demolition of the Babri Masjid, but you know, in public, they never gave up on each other. You can see, one hand, you can say that, you know, it's wrong. Vajpayee should have probably, condemned. I mean, he condemned the event as such. Similarly, he also condemned what happened in Gujarat. But, you know, they never fell out. You know, they never fell out. They, in fact, they became the ideal foil for each other. You know, they played it. That's why he's calling it Jugalbandi, you know. The instruments could be playing... Mm-hmm. A music that is sometimes may not be very coordinated, but all the time together. You know, that's something that the opposition should learn. Today we see what's happening. You know, people are uneasy about what's happening in the Congress, and even the other regional parties are not coming together as a cohesive unit to oppose BJP. I think that's something that they have to learn. You have to merge at one point, which is a sort of a narrative. If you want a narrative, there's always a narrative in the past. So that's something that that's a lesson that the people could learn from this book.
So similar, what I would like to add is that you started with the Jugalbandi, which basically started from, say, start of 1990s. Yeah, so I was reading a book about a few years earlier. It was about Rajiv Gandhi. It's written by Wajahat Habibullah. It is called My Years with Rajiv.
Okay.
So I can really connect when you say that when these people, you know, the writers give a human angle to a story. So even here, the way Habibullah has described the events of the tenure of Rajiv Gandhi, giving the history of the entire, for example, the Assam Accord and what was the history of that, you could as if feel that you were there, you know, like when all these... historic decisions were being taken. So you get that first-hand account, and it's something that it just transports you in a different world. And it's very nice to see that human angle of people who are always projected in power, who are always... You make an opinion about themselves. Okay, they would talk like this, they would have interests like this. But then, you know, when you look at the other side of it,
yeah,
it's totally different. Like, I would say we are seeing the 180 degree view. These books probably add another 90 degrees, so you get the 270 degree. Of course, you wouldn't get the 360 degree view, because
you can't get into the mind of the exact emotions of what's going on. But mm-hmm. They open a small window into their emotional self. And the emotional self is always very different, by the way. You know, it's sort of, they say that, you know, when you win something, when you actually win, the win could be sometimes bitter. The victory could be sometimes bitter because, you know, you would have damaged a lot of who you are in winning. You know, this is the human nature. And that you can... very well see, even Rajiv Gandhi, for example, if you look at Rajiv Gandhi, his relationship with Narasimha Rao was very, very different. You know, I read that Sitapati relates a couple of instances where you can say that, you know, these two come from a very, very different background. One is a sort of a son of the soil kind of a guy, you know, who's from Telangana. Learns to speak about five languages by himself, and then you know, remarkably, he handles his sidelining really well. He handles his failures really well. That's why Narasimha Rao is such a strong leader. You know, like, for example, he was the chief minister of Andhra Pradesh in the 1970s. And then, you know, he was actually asked to resign because his land reforms kind of creates a rift within his party. And, you know, it's sort of difficult to sustain him. So Indira Gandhi removes him. And then when he goes out of power, he goes to the United States and then, you know, he becomes a scholar outside of the political theater. Narasimha Rao, you know, was a pure scholar. And then when he comes back, he comes with some learning, some education. He doesn't come back and repeat the same mistakes, you know. And also the one man who was capable of becoming a prime minister because he was a external affairs minister, home minister, education minister, health minister, law minister. Imagine a man holding all these portfolios under two prime ministers, Indira Gandhi and, you know, Rajiv Gandhi. And naturally, you know, when he becomes prime minister, he comes with that astuteness. And, you know, he's such a, you know, wonderfully smart politician that you love, you kind of fall in love with this guy when you read. You know, I was actually, and I used to admire him even as a college student. But, you know, looking at his life in full, you know, you sort of can't help admiring.
I mean, we've spoken about one Jugalbandi, which is Vajpayee and Advani. There were several, I feel. Now, we've had Narasimha Rao and Dr. Manmohan Singh and Dr. Manmohan Singh and Sonia Gandhi. And then now we have Modi and Amit Shah. So,
yes, that's very true. I agree that... But yeah, though they may not be the kind of the longevity may not be the same as Vajpayee Advani, they were nonetheless very significant because Manmohan Singh remained the only politician, probably still remains the only one, who continues to attend Narasimha Rao's birthday. You know, they have a memorial organized for him every year, I believe. And, you know, Manmohan Singh always was present. Because, you know, the way he kind of supported him during the liberalization phase, because they were drawing a lot of flack because they have to completely turn Congress from a socialist to a free market supporting party. It was not easy at all. So, yeah. I mean, again, Amit Shah and Modi, of course, the jury is still out, he says. And I believe so because we have to see how it unfolds because it just... you know, what about our 25-year-old relationship? We yet to see how it's going to, the dynamics of it would change or how it's going to change, we don't know.
Now, diverging a little bit, sir, like my night and day is still incomplete. So I am a little bit distraught about that fact.
Oh, that is, what happened?
I don't know. It's like, maybe I'm reading, it was written about, a century ago. So maybe I think it is universal. It is still relevant. The story is still relevant. But I think the sort of language is what I feel is something which is, you know, which needs time. You need like a lot of time to sit back, you know, look at the whole text and understand it, absorb it. I think that is pretty exhaustive for a millennial. I don't know if I agree with this.
Even I have. I can sympathize with you because I have the same kind of struggles with the classics. Because I would like to boast actually to say that I've in fact read some classics, but unfortunately, you know, I have the same problem. Okay, at what point of the story are you in right now?
Okay, so in about a week, it's been a painfully slow week for me. So last week I had finished like chapter five. And now it is chapter 6. So just one chapter a week. So I'm a bit distraught about that. So I don't know because I'm reading it in my Kindle app in my phone. So one page is divided further into, like if you have page number, say 25 or 24, you have three screens or four screens or five screens of the same page number, probably because of the text. So I don't know if it's sort of a... psychological thing that, you know, because there are so many pages, I'm just getting exhausted about that, or
yes.
I don't know, should I shift to another screen and see if I can read faster.
Physical book and see how it works. Maybe it would work better for you because some people have problems with Kindle and reading on the
phone. Yeah, no, I prefer a physical book which I can hold and I don't
exactly.
know.
Exactly. You come across as one. Because, if you have problems with reading books on the Kindle, it's usually that, you need a physical book. Okay, have you distracted yourself with something else?
Oh, yeah. I went, as you suggested last time, so I picked up, from my cleaned bookshelf now, I picked up Jeffrey Archer's Sins of the Father. I should tell you that, at first when you said the book is unputdownable, I had certain doubts. Like, okay, let me see how it goes. All right. So I'll tell you this one particular incident. So I was running late for an assignment and I was like, okay, let me just relax my mind and then just, start the assignment. So I picked up this book. So it's Night and Day is going nowhere. Let's put down my phone. Let's pick up this book. It's a the physical book. So I just pick it up and I just start reading it. It was true. It was literally true that I couldn't put it down. Even though some part of my brain was saying, Ahmed, you're running late. I was like, okay, wait. We can do it later. So I finished, with very, very heavy heart. I finished the chapter one and then closed the book. It's so true. It's unputdownable. It's very true.
Yes. And imagine you have 7 books. Not just one.
Yeah, exactly. My God.
You have a treat waiting for you. I don't know when you're going to be. Maybe you need a continuous couple of days or maybe two, three days even to sit down and read it completely. But yes, I'm sure you would love it.
Yeah. And you said about 7 books are a treat of a books, right? So I just want to ask you this one question. Are you the sort of person who would like, okay, I pick up one book, no matter what happens, I'm going to finish this and then go start with another, a one phase, like a straight go person, like in a straight line, you move like that, or you go like a round robin fashion. Okay, I'm going to finish a bit of this, a bit of that.
Yes. Well, this. I'll tell you something, let me put it, use this analogy. It's like going for a date, it's like a blind date with a book, some books are worth, kind of continuing with. It's not because you kind of want to sort of live up to your challenge and, want to do what you always resolved yourself to do. No, it's not that. It's basically the book that carries you, If the book is extraordinarily interesting. I tell you, I never thought I will finish Vinay Sitapati's 2 books in 3 days. I never thought so.
Wow.
But this is, mind you, this is after I struggled with 7 or 8 books. Okay, I kind of read about a couple of chapters of one book and then gave up that book. And then, Obama was probably the first lengthy book that I kind of stuck to. Largely because of the way it's written, So it's basically, the sort of digestibility or the ability of the book to sustain your interest. I think that's what it all comes down to. Otherwise, it's not going to happen, Sometimes, it's our mind that it's like a conflict of your heart and your mind. Your mind says you have to read, but your heart says, there's something better, I can read that. Maybe that's the moment of, that particular moment, probably you're not ready for the book. That's what I feel. You have to be ready for the book.
I mean, it reminds me of another analogy. It's more like a buffet. Like, you go there.
That's true. Very true. Yeah.
If you like the, sweets, okay, we'll have another one. No issues. Like.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So you kind of develop a certain craving for some books, and then you just go with the flow. I think that's what it all comes down to. That's why I don't even believe in the fact that, you have to keep an account of how much that you read. How many books you finish, 100 books a year. I never get into that trap. Of course, I'd like to try that. But I never sort of take it too seriously because, reading is not an activity in which you have to sort of labor. it's not an activity of labor, it's an activity of joy. It's an activity of, you know, complete freedom, you know. Remember, we spoke mm-hmm. about, you know, just lying down on this cart or, you know, your couch and then, you know, kind of going about with it, you know, without any care for what's happening around you. That kind of a freedom, yeah. You know, that's whichever book that gives you, I think you should follow your heart more than your mind when it comes to the books.
true. Yes. So anything for next week, sir? What's your TBR, sir? What have you in store?
Yeah, TBR consists of a book called A Burning. And mm-hmm. I'll tell you, I mean, I started to just browse through the book. And what I found is that it is a crackling novel. It's one of the best after perhaps Narcopolis or, you know, that kind of a novel. Of course, I have a problem with the book, which I'll probably discuss next week, because I need to complete the book and then tell you if my understanding of the book is right. And I'm kind of warming up to the book now. And it's a brilliant writing for a first debut author, you know, Megha Majumdar. It's a fantastic book. It's something that I would definitely recommend for people to read, because the writing just comes alive, you know. That's the kind of a book that kind of wins your heart and keeps you loyal. What about you?
Okay, so this is the second time I'm going to repeat, so I'll try finishing Night and Day. Okay. So yes. I'll probably do this thing. So I'll just close the Kindle copy. I'll just see if I can lay my hands on a physical copy and see if I can, you know, finish it faster. How engaging a physical copy is. I think that will make a good understanding of, you know, myself. Like, do I like reading on phone, or, you know, I have a physical copy. So I'll do that. And then, of course, Sins of the Father is there. So I'll just continue with that and see.
Sure. It's like having a cake locked up in the closet, you know. You won't forget it.
yeah. And I haven't forgotten the plot line also. So I don't have to read the first chapter again. So I'll just start up with the second. So, and then, of course, there are last two chapters left of Wajahat Habibullah's My Years with Rajiv.
Okay.
And I'll see that book. Yeah.
You know what? I think that's very appealing to me. I kind of came across this book for a couple of times on Kindle book. But as you kind of narrate what is there in it, I'm kind of getting some interest to read that. So that will also go into my TBR for the coming week.
Yes, that'll be great. So let's hope next week is, it's already the end of the year. So December is here. So I'm all waiting. It's winter already started in Bangalore. So I'm pretty much excited for it. Yeah.
So I also wish you a very good reading time for the rest of the month, because this is a new month, and I'm sure you know, you sort of always keep your screen fresh or you know, your shelf fresh,
so yes,
you can pick up the best ones.
True. Let's hope that this week is a very fruitful week. Sure, sir. It was
thank
great
you very much,
to have
and, good reading and good time, and let's hope that we also get to hear a lot from the listeners
and
ideas and advices for us.
sure, we'll definitely do this. Yep.
Right. Thank you, Ahmed. Thank you. See you next
Thank
week.
You.
Bye.
See you next week, sir. Bye. That's all in today's episode. Tune in this evening on a news update podcast from the newsroom to catch all the exciting developments of the day and to get the news while it's still budding. For latest news and updates, log on to www.deccanherald.com. Check out our e-paper at www.deccanheraldepaper.com. To read news on the go, sign up to our Telegram channel t.me/deccanheraldnews. Keep up with the news from your interested sphere by downloading the all-new Deccan Herald app, in which you can personalize, have quick glance at news shots, check highlights, and even listen
listening to. You can get it from Google Play Store and Apple App Store, and you can find the links to the same in the description.